Good evening. This is Life Rattle, the story show. I'm your host, Lori Callis. Tonight, on Life Rattle number 1216, we present the first of a two-part Then and Now program, featuring the stories of Life Rattle writer Diane Donaghy. Diane Donaghy was first introduced to Life Rattle listeners as Diane Tiley back in December of 1988. Her stories were featured on the 5th and the 8th Life Rattle radio program almost 24 years ago. Diane contacted us recently with a new story she's written. We leapt at the opportunity to welcome Diane back into the Life Rattle fold and to revisit Life Rattle's earliest years. To keep with the then and now theme, tonight's program features Diane as Diane Tiley. We'll open with the original introduction to Diane's first story, E. Pluribus Unum, and her biography at the time, as they were both originally aired on Life Rattle program number 5, hosted by the late Arnie Actman, who, with Guy Allen, founded Life Rattle. On next week's program, Life Rattle number 1217, we will feature Diane as Diane Donaghy with her updated bio and her new story. Let's listen now to Arnie Actman's introduction and Diane Tiley's reading of her story, E. Pluribus Unum, 24 years later, tonight on Life Rattle.
E. Pluribus Unum takes place in a normal high school in, the east end of Toronto, Riverdale High. Riverdale High is also the name of the high school in the Archie comics, and I think that's appropriate because of the tone in Diane's story is not unlike that of an Archie comic. There is the main concern is with being popular, and it has all the elements of what goes on in high school. Except these are a little more real life. They involve skipping class, going to the greasy spoon, playing pinball. And the tone of the narrator in E. Pluribus Unum is more like Jughead than like Archie. It's kind of an innocent humor and a naive flaunting of conventions. What happens in the story is that the narrator wants to be popular, and she gets her chance when she helps one of the two stars in the grade cheat on a Latin test, and they invite her to skip class a couple of weeks from then and join them at the Greasy Spoon. This is her first time doing anything that would get her in trouble, the narrator's first time. The narrator sees herself as an outsider, which is almost a universal viewpoint when you're in high school. I don't know too many people who see themselves as insiders when they're there. There's always somebody else who's does something better or who's got nicer clothes or who can do things a little more smoothly. The narrator sees herself as an outsider because she gets above average marks, because she's uncoordinated in gym class, and because the only boy who ever talks to her is a school jerk. And most of all, she's not like Patsy and Ann, the stars of grade 10, who are neither too smart nor too dumb, who never miss a swing, a pass, a stroke, or a volley, and who can't walk down the halls without drawing the boys' admiration. The narrator's preoccupation with Patsy and Ann verges on an obsession. She lies in bed at night and wonders why she can't be popular like them. And when she is invited to join them, she dreams that she is transformed simply by her by being next to Patsy and Ann. E. Pluribus Unum is a kind of rites of passage tale where the main character goes through an ordeal, does something she has never done before, and does it despite all her fears and her apprehensions, and comes out the other side wiser. Diane Tiley is a real Toronto native, one of the few that I've ever met. She was born and raised in Toronto and has lived here all her life. The action of E Pluribus Unum takes place in 1972 in grade 10 in Riverdale High. So let's listen now to Diane Tiley's story, E Pluribus Unum, on Life Rattle. Okay, there's some technical difficulties. I'm going to start this one over. I think we're ready now. All right, this is Diane Tiley in E Pluribus Unum.
In my high school, the super smart kids and the super dumb ones were equally unpopular. I fell into the former category in every subject but Latin. I never wanted to take Latin, but the year I entered Riverdale Collegiate, there was a stupid rule. If you had an overall 70% average or more in junior high, Latin was compulsory. I always had to struggle to stay awake in that class. The teacher didn't help much. Miss Hoey was an old crow with a prune face. Her nasal voice droned on. She turned bright red and yelled when she caught anyone whispering or not paying attention. It seemed she was always yelling. She expected students to naturally find Latin fascinating. Once someone sneaked into the classroom between periods and wrote on the chalkboard, "Latin is the language of the dead, and it's killing me." It took Miss Hoey 10 minutes to quiet the laughter. Patsy Phillips and Ann Collins were the most popular girls in my class. They were neither too bright nor too dull, and excelled in all sports. Having very little coordination as a teen, I dreaded gym class. I was often the reason my team lost whatever game we played. I got bugged a lot in the change room afterward, usually by Patsy or Ann. They never missed a swing, a pass, a stroke, or a volley. They had dates for every school dance. They couldn't walk down the corridor between classes without several boys calling out or playfully teasing them. The only boy who ever teased me was John Bergeron, the school jerk. I hated him with a passion. I lay in bed at night and wondered why I couldn't be popular like Patsy or Ann. My mom said that brains were far more important than popularity. I wasn't convinced. Nearly the entire Latin class used cheat cards for tests. Tiny pieces of paper with as much information as was humanly possible crammed onto them. Some of the braver kids wrote stuff on their arms in ink, casually rolling up their sleeves as the tests progressed. The class egghead, Calvin Loeffler, never cheated on any tests, yet always got over 90%. No one gave him the time of day. One day, just before Latin class, Patsy stopped me in the hallway. "Hey, Tiley, I forgot a cheat card for the test. Can I borrow yours?" Without hesitating, I said sure. I ran to the washroom and quickly copied out a cheat card for Patsy. "Thanks, Tiley, you're okay," was reward enough for me. Next day, I held my breath while Miss Hoey gave the test papers back. I forced myself to glance over at Patsy. I saw her giving Anne the high sign. She had passed. I wore a silly grin on my face the rest of the day. Several weeks later, Anne approached me in the change room after gym class. I figured she was going to rag out since I'd missed the serve in volleyball. I was all set to apologize when she said, "Patsy and me are going to skip Latin tomorrow. You want to join us?" Suddenly hoarse, I managed to stammer, "Sure, but where will we go?" "To the Cornerstone, of course," she replied. The Cornerstone was a little greasy spoon a block from school. It had pinball machines in the back. "That sounds great, Anne." I couldn't believe my luck at the sudden honor being bestowed on me. The two most popular girls in class had actually chosen me to skip Latin with them. I lay awake for hours that night, rehearsing over and over the witty things I'd say. When I finally fell asleep, I dreamed Patsy, Anne, and I became fast friends. Five boys asked me to the next school dance because Patsy told them how neat I was. I excelled in gym class forever after. Then I woke up. In the morning, I played with my cereal, too keyed up to eat. Mom noticed and said, "I hope you're not coming down with something." "I'm fine, just not hungry today," I replied. "Well, gotta run. See you after school." I planted a quick kiss on her cheek, grabbed my books, and rushed out the door. I couldn't concentrate all morning on anything the teachers said. Twice I got called on and gave the wrong answer. Creepy John Bergeron giggled. I shot him a dirty look. Latin was the second class after lunch. It was the longest lunch hour on record. I searched for Patsy and Anne in the lunchroom, but they weren't around. What if they were playing a trick on me? What if I skipped Latin and they ended up going just so I'd get in trouble? What if... Oh, stop it. Don't blow your big chance to be popular now. After math class, I hid out in the washroom for a few minutes while the others made their way to Latin. I had a lump in my throat. This was the first time I'd tried to do anything I could get in trouble for. Like a spy, I slipped from the washroom and stole out the side entrance. My heart thudded in my chest as I bolted across the schoolyard. I didn't want to wait until the light turned green. I figured dodging traffic was safer than the risk of being spotted. With a shaky hand, I pushed open the door of the cornerstone and strode in. I spotted Patsy's long red hair spilling out of the back booth. What a relief. How's it going, guys? I tried to sound casual as I slipped into the booth next to Anne. Hunky-dory, want a drag? Knowing I couldn't possibly decline, although I'd never smoked, I said, thanks, Pats, and took a puff. What's the matter, Tylee? Never smoked before? Anne snickered as I hacked up a storm. Patsy had to slap me on the back. I'm trying to quit. Doctor's orders, I managed between coughs. We chatted idly about boys for several minutes. Then Anne challenged Patsy to a game of pinball. Come on, Tylee, you can play the winner, she offered. Patsy's score was up to 680,520 when my turn came. I'd only played pinball twice before, but seemed to have a knack for it. Before long, I was only 100 points behind Patsy, who looked miffed. Yay, Diane! It's about time somebody showed her up, Anne cheered. I was on top of the world at that moment. Suddenly, the smile on Anne's face died. Turning around, I bumped into Miss Hoey. Her face was all red. Miss Hoey, what a surprise! Aren't you supposed to be in class? I instantly regretted my remark, although both girls tittered. It's pretty hard to teach a class of 7 students, she angrily replied. With so many pupils absent today, Mr. Peters said he'd take my class while I went for a coffee. We didn't smile at her weird sense of humor. Why did everyone have to pick the same day to skip Latin, I wondered. All right, you three, Mr. Peters wants to see you in his office straight away. I felt sick. My mom would ground me forever. Patsy appeared nonchalant, and Anne did her best to look tough, but I thought I saw a tear in the corner of her eye. The party was definitely over. Mr. Peters questioned us separately. He wanted to know whose brilliant idea it was to skip Latin. If he'd cut off my right arm and hung me by my toenails, I'd never have told on the girls. I said we simply met at the restaurant by coincidence. I guess they said the same, because we each got a week's detention. Mr. Peters said he was most shocked at my behavior, since I'd always been such a good student. I didn't say anything. Detention time passed uneventfully. Miss Hoey didn't hold a grudge, and soon everything was back to normal. It would have been pretty hard to hold a grudge against 3/4 of the class. My mom cut off my allowance for 2 weeks. I wasn't allowed to watch TV either. That was the worst punishment of all. I never became fast friends with Patsy or Anne. It was nearly a year before I got a date for the school dance. I continued to be clumsy and uncoordinated in gym class. However, those two girls never teased me in the change room again.
That was Diane Tylee reading her story, E Pluribus Unum. The theme of tonight's second featured story is universal and, appropriately on tonight's program, timeless. Let's listen now as Diane Tylee reads her story, My First Love.
This one's titled, My First Love. First time I saw Marcel, he was tearing down third baseline toward home plate. He jumped into the air, throwing his arms up as he landed on the base. I thought that was a cute gesture. I was definitely interested in Marcel, but too shy to do anything about it. At 12, I was an introvert. My love of reading earned me the nickname Bookworm. The only sport I enjoyed was baseball. This was mostly due to my best friend Rose. She and her 2 younger brothers were members of the Galt Gurus, the local team named after our street. Rose often called for me, baseball glove and ball in hand, saying, come on, Di, I need someone to practice with. Eventually, I managed to hit a few and found I was having fun. With Rose's encouragement, I joined the team. Marcel Levesque was 13 years old. His birthday was one day after mine, a fact I found most significant. His straight, dark blonde hair was longer than most boys his age. He constantly brushed it back out of his eyes, I found that funny since his father owned the local barber shop. Marcel had china blue eyes, the kind it's hard to look away from once you look into them. He was just taller than I, with a medium build. Although he'd smiled at me a few times, it seemed he was always chatting and joking with the other girls on the baseball team. I figured I didn't stand a chance. One day, while at bat, the pitcher threw two terrible cockeyed balls at me. Over-anxious, I struck at them both and missed. Marcel yelled out, "New pitcher, new pitcher! Give her something she can hit!" My cheeks turned scarlet. When the new pitcher threw the next ball, I struck at it with all my might and hit it way up into the air. As I charged by first base, I saw the catcher miss it. "Run, Di, run!" Marcel's voice was the only one I heard. I landed safe on third. Marcel went up next and hit us both home. Our whole team cheered. I was too thrilled to be embarrassed. Marcel's older sister Pat was also on the team. I chatted with her every chance I got. I wanted her to like me, hoping she'd put in a good word about me to Marcel. After school one day, I was doing my homework on the veranda when Pat strode up the walk. I went in and got her a Pepsi. "My brother wants to know if you'll go steady with him," she announced between sips. "What?" I nearly choked on my orange soda. "Come on, Di, I know you like him. He made me promise to get your answer tonight." "Yes. Tell Marcel I'd be happy to go steady with him," I croaked. "Yeah? Great. Anyways, I gotta go. See you at the game tomorrow night." The next 24 hours were spent in total agony. Why didn't Marcel ask me something so important himself? He wasn't shy like me. What if it was all a big joke at my expense? My hands shook so badly I could hardly tie my shoelaces before the game. I called for Rose and told her the news. She said it was a fantastic coincidence, since Marcel's best friend Rick had also asked her to go steady. "Did he ask you in person?" I wanted to know. "Not exactly. He phoned me last night." Were those two in some kind of contest? I pushed the thought aside as we arrived at the park. The game was already underway. There was no time to say anything more than hi to the boys. I had a knot in my stomach, and my palms were sweaty. The game seemed to take forever. Afterwards, Rose and I deliberately stood around making idle chatter. Marcel walked up behind me. "Hey, Di." "Yes?" I turned around so quickly I nearly collided with him. "Do you girls have to go home right now?" "No way," I answered, trying to sound flip. "Do you two want to come over to Rick's place for a pop? His parents are at the movies." "Sure," Rose and I chorused. We sounded too much like the Bobbsey twins. After Rick paid his little sister 50 cents to take off for an hour, we had the place to ourselves. We all sat on the huge overstuffed sofa while Rick put on a record. The moment I heard Paul Anka singing, "Put Your Head on My Shoulder," my heart started to race. Marcel turned to me and said in a low voice, "Why don't you do what he says?" Giggling nervously, I complied. Moments later, he whispered, "How about a kiss?" I'd never kissed a boy my own age before. Relatives didn't count. I tilted my face upward and closed my eyes. His lips met the corner of my chin. We opened our eyes, chuckled, and tried again. So this was a real kiss. I got a strange feeling in the pit of my stomach, sort of like going up in an elevator really fast. By the time he walked me to my door that night, I was head over heels in love with Marcel Levesque. Rose confessed she felt the same about Rick. For the next 2 weeks, Marcel called for me almost every day after school. We sat on my veranda by the hour, drinking pop and playing his transistor radio as loudly as my mom would allow. We covered every subject from who was most likely to win the series to Herman's Hermit's latest concert. Marcel always had me giggling, only I wasn't nervous anymore. He had the best sense of humor. I gave him the honor of signing my autograph book right next to the page with David Cassidy's signature. Marcel wrote, "She wore a tulip, he wore a rose. They both got arrested, they should have worn clothes." I showed it to everyone, proud as a peacock. One day, Marcel didn't show up at my place after school. I phoned him. Pat said he was out, but she'd get him to call me. He didn't call back. Certain that Pat forgot to give him the message, I tried not to worry. I bought a brand new baseball glove with my allowance and planned to give it to him. When he didn't show the following afternoon, I phoned again. His mother said he wasn't home. This time I was upset. I thought I'd walk over to the park. We had a game in 2 hours. Maybe he was practicing. I hid the present in my gym bag to surprise him. He'd probably reward me with one of his gorgeous smiles, or maybe even a kiss. I was practically skipping as I arrived at the park. The baseball diamond was deserted. Glancing over to the kids' play area, I saw Marcel sitting on the swing. I started toward him, then halted dead in my tracks. He wasn't alone. A girl with flaming red hair and a yellow sundress sat in the next swing. Her laughter sounded like music. I turned and ran, hurling the baseball glove into a mud puddle. I tore into my house out of breath, tears streaming down my face. "Whatever's the matter, dear?" my mom asked, concerned. We shared a pitcher of iced tea as I told her the awful news. "You mustn't be too upset, darling. Young boys are nearly always fickle. He doesn't deserve someone as clever and pretty as you. There will be plenty better than him soon enough, you'll see." I dried my tears on her handkerchief and managed a crooked smile. I quit the baseball team the next day. The thought of facing Marcel again was just too painful.
That was Diane Tiley reading her story, My First Love. Tonight's final story starts early in the morning as 17-year-old Diane heads off for her first day of her first job at a silk screening factory. There she encounters much more than pounding machines and caustic chemicals. Let's listen now as Diane Tiley reads her story, Factory Blues.
This one's about my first job, and it's called Factory Blues. At 17, I abandoned secretarial college to pursue a career in silk screen printing. Crazy David's T-shirt factory was looking for trainees. I rushed down there. After filling out an application, I was interviewed by Les, the burly foreman. "Can you start tomorrow?" he asked, looking me up and down. "Sure can," I replied. I nearly missed my subway stop, daydreaming about my exciting new career all the way home. I wasn't so thrilled when the alarm clock rang at 5:30 a.m. "Oh, well, I'll just have to get used to this," I reasoned, splashing cold water on my face. I had to rush to meet Les in front of the nearby shopping plaza at 6:30. He offered me a ride every morning since he lived only a few blocks away. Starting time wasn't until 8 o'clock, but Les always arrived early. "So how come a pretty girl like you is still single?" he wanted to know. "I'm engaged," I lied. "You're too young to settle down." "I'm also too young for you. Besides, my boyfriend is super jealous." "What does he do for a living?" "He teaches martial arts," I answered quickly, smiling sweetly at him. That shut Les up for about 5 minutes. "So, you're engaged. You're not dead yet. There's still time for one last fling before you take the plunge. I bet your boyfriend's going for it." I sighed. It was going to be a long drive. Finally, we reached the intersection of King and Peter Streets in the warehouse district. Les dropped me off at the greasy spoon next to Crazy David's. He asked me to order his breakfast while he parked. Not knowing any of my co-workers yet, I chose a back booth and sat alone. When Les arrived, he said, "Go sit up front with the gang and get acquainted." He patted my behind as I passed by. I ignored him. The gang consisted of a reed-thin girl about my age, with long stringy hair hanging in her eyes, a bony fellow with frizzy red hair and a wild look, an old wrinkled Italian lady dressed entirely in black, and a strikingly handsome blonde guy who stood up as I approached. "Hi, I'm Bob. Welcome to the madhouse," he said cheerfully. His china blue eyes made my knees weak. After breakfast, we all filed into the factory, punching our cards into the time clock. I began to sweat immediately. I asked Karen, the thin girl, when they turned the air conditioning on. She said I had a great sense of humor. Les told Heather, a plump, bleached blonde, to show me the different positions on the assembly line. 10 minutes later, I realized this was the extent of my training. I took my place on the line, smiling brightly. By lunchtime, my throat was parched, my arms felt like they were falling off, and my head throbbed from the din of the machines. I was surprised to find the oppressive heat outside not much cooler than the factory. At least it was fresh air. A bunch of us got takeout food from the greasy spoon and walked to the little park nearby. As I dejectedly munched my sandwich, Bob patted my shoulder. "Don't worry, kiddo, you're doing fine. The first day's always the worst." I whistled all the way back to work. I approached Les in the afternoon, inquiring when I'd get to work with the silk screens. He gave me a strange grin. "You want to work with the screens? No problem. I'll start you right now." I was pleased.
All I had to do was ask, I thought. Les handed me two filthy screens dripping with paint. Here you go. Take these down to the basement and dip them in the vat. Don't come up till they're good and clean. I trudged down the stairs, cursing my big mouth. Les called after me. Better use the rubber gloves. Wouldn't want you to ruin those pretty hands. The vat was a huge urn filled with solvents. It smelled awful. I tied my hair back, afraid it would disintegrate if it got near the bubbling mess. I started scrubbing the screens with a wire brush. Tears streamed down my face from the fumes. Suddenly, I sensed someone behind me. I turned and looked straight into Bob's gorgeous blue eyes. That Les is a real PR. Here, let me help you. Bob finished the dreadful task while I looked on. I don't know how to thank you, I told Bob as he washed his hands afterwards. This will do nicely, he replied, planting a big kiss on my lips. Maybe this job will turn out okay after all, I mused, soaking in a bubble bath that night. How did you make out with the screens yesterday? Les asked as we drove in the next morning. He emphasized the words make out. No problem, I replied. Someone must have seen us. I was in for trouble now. But Les seemed nonchalant, so I quickly changed the subject. I was beginning to relax by mid-morning when Les called me off the assembly line. I had a prime position beside Heather, smoothing the T-shirts over the screen for her to pull the lever on the first press. Heather's seniority allowed her the spot near the only fan, which blew on half of me anyway. Diane switched places with Karen, Les said evenly. So this was his revenge. Folding T-shirts around cardboard as they slid off the press was the most tedious job in the factory, also the sweatiest, since most of the heat was concentrated at that end of the machinery. For how long, I asked. Until I say so, told me it was useless to argue. I plopped down beside Maria, the old Italian woman. She began jabbering away in Italian. No capisce, I replied in the only Italian I knew. She shot me a dirty look. The rest of the day was a constant battle to stay awake. The sweltering heat, the monotony of the job, and the conveyor belt's steady hum mesmerized me. It made my head thick and my eyelids heavy. By quitting time, I knew I'd have to do something to prevent falling asleep. I mentioned this to Bob as we walked to the bus stop together. I've got just the thing, he said, handing me a small red pill. Take it with your morning coffee, and this little sucker will perk you up for the whole day. When he flashed those baby blues, I'd have swallowed cyanide if he recommended it. I was up before the alarm went off, eagerly anticipating the boost my little friend would give me. When Les saw how quickly I worked, he was bound to put me back in front with Heather. In the restaurant, Bob glanced at my empty coffee cup and winked. I giggled, smug at our secret. Half an hour later, I couldn't understand why I didn't feel perky yet. My head was actually fuzzier than ever, and my eyelids felt like lead weights lay on them. What's the matter for you? Maria asked crossly. My head nodded back and forth. You no sleep last night? I mumbled a retort as I tried to keep pace with the T-shirts. They were running off the conveyor belt at lightning speed. My drugged eyes glanced at the clock. Only 9:45 and I was already drifting away. Could Bob have accidentally given me the wrong kind of pill? This was my last conscious thought before slumping over the conveyor belt. T-shirts spilled over me. I awoke to Les roughly shaking my shoulders. Maria shouted excitedly in Italian. I looked up groggily. 50 pairs of eyes stared back. Thinking it strangely quiet, I realized the presses were no longer running. A huge pile of T-shirts lay scattered around my feet. Everyone looked angry. I was relieved when Les pulled me into his office. Handing me a glass of water, he asked if I was all right. I think so. I must have fainted, I stammered. Les lifted my chin up. Your eyes are all glazed. Are you on drugs? He demanded. I thought it was a wake-up pill. Honest, Les. Bob gave it to me. You can even ask him. That's pretty hard to do. He quit this morning, Les replied as he wrote out my pink slip. We can't have stone employees here. You're a bad influence on the others. I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to fire you. He didn't look sorry at all. I crumpled the pink slip into my purse. My career as a silkscreen printer was remarkably short.
That was Diane Tiley reading her story, Factory Blues. That concludes Life Rattle number 1216. My name is Lori Callis. Arnie Ackman and Diane's father recorded Diane reading her stories. Life Rattle was created by Guy Allen and Arnie Ackman. Tune into Life Rattle next Sunday night at 9 to hear part 2 of our Then and Now program, featuring a new story by Diane Donahue.